you might have occasion to make some notes in the margins of your Bible, or otherwise just to reinforce what you'll see up here, you know, in your own personal Bible. And so, as I say in a moment, looking at the very same verses that were read a moment ago by Evan at the start of the assembly, 1 Corinthians chapter 9. As you're turning, we have a title slide that you can see is labeled as the original site of the Olympic Games. We'll be thinking somewhat about this very place in the course of our lesson this morning. It was a location that had dominated the Grecian Empire and the Roman one to follow it, as you can also see there, from 776 B.C. to about 393 A.D., and as a matter of fact, at the time of the apostles, this location was at the height of its popularity. Much like the Olympics that we have today, those athletic events that are named after this place and exist because of this place, now though, you know, at various locations around the world, this is where that entire idea all began. And at the time of Christ, it was in the course of each of these events, when they held the games, it was the biggest thing in the Roman Empire. It was an opportunity to make contacts, not just because you enjoy, you know, the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat, but those that were merchants across the Roman Empire, those that had a need for political ties and that sort of thing, would also come. So if you had anything to sell, you would do your best to get to the biggest trade show and county fair, you know, that there was, this one for the entire empire. So while that looks, you know, kind of tiny right there, we have just this one, you know, little racetrack that is left. You can imagine just tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people coming throughout centuries to this location. I might also add that it is very specifically in Grecian and Roman mythology attached to their god Zeus. Zeus is what this was all about. This was as much a religious location for idolatry as it was, you know, simply a sporting venue. So it kind of looms very large over New Testament times, and I think forms the backdrop for what Paul will be saying now in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Here in 1 Corinthians 9, and beginning in that 23rd verse, he says, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air, but I discipline my body and make it my slave, so that after I've preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified." Now, before we even start thinking about these verses and what it is that Paul has to say for these people, let's please be remembering that Paul, number one, has been setting himself apart as an example, a constant example. Look at me, do what I say, do what I do, be who I am. And secondly, there will be a conclusion to this that is all about a charge to these people. So he's not just talking about himself in this passage. He's talking about others, these people as well. So don't you know, those that run a race all run, run so that you can win. This is Paul's life. This is Paul's example. This is Paul's prayer. This is Paul's hope. This is Paul's command. And it's Paul's mission that for these Corinthians and every other one who names the name of Christ, then and now, that we might learn something from his life as it's also depicted at this location, the site of the Olympics, dominating, you know, the thoughts of the Roman Empire in his time, captivating the imagination. There are, by the way, training venues all over the Roman Empire. Every nation, like we do today, had these training venues. Their athletes were working out year-round, just like ours do today. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in everything, in all things. Self-control. They care about what they eat. They care when they rise and when they go to sleep. They care about not injuring themselves, so they're protecting their bodies everywhere they go, even when they have other responsibilities at home, from chopping firewood to whatever else it might be. They are constantly alert and aware that the athlete has set themselves as having one absolute goal in life. It is to get to that place. And when the starter gives the signal, be the first one, the best one, the fastest one, the strongest one at the end of whatever goal it is that we're talking about. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, wreath for an imperishable. Therefore, I run, he says, in such a way as not without aim. He's not just wandering. He's not just sightseeing. It's not just for fun. I run in such a way as with an aim, to reverse the negative that he employed. I know what it is I'm trying to accomplish. I see it every day and moment of my life. I'm living this thing constantly. My aim is to be in constant training, carefully concerned about everything I do, so that when that moment comes, I'm the winner. Not second place, not third place, gold. Not silver, not bronze. In 26, there were many different events, of course, that took place then as they do now. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. But I buffet my body and make it my slave, lest possibly after I have preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. Now, you've all heard, you know, the observation, I have no doubt, that if Paul, as an inspired, miracle-working apostle, needs to be behaving in this way, constantly training, then how much more you and I? One would think that he's just kind of that natural-born athlete, that he could go ahead, you know, and just expect that the power and the speed and all the reserves, you know, would be there when he needed them. But it's nothing like that. Paul never trades on the past. He is forever in training. And this expression, buffeting my body, disciplining my body, depending on your translation, making it my slave so that he himself not be disqualified, suggests, you know, that it's not even just the heavy breathing and the sore muscles and, you know, the agony that comes from runners, but taking abuse of the body from punches, from blows. Boxers have to get in the ring and spar. Paul says, that fight is between me and me. I have to win that fight against the flesh. So the Galatian letter, you know, gives us the works of the flesh, and Paul is in training. You know, maybe you've seen the new Rocky movies. You know, what is this? 7 and 8, I think. Something like that, however many there are in the Rocky series. I always remember the first one came out in 78 because Don and I carried an infant, not many months ago, born baby to the first one. Up and watched you. We saw that first Rocky movie. Okay, set the stage for his life. But the point is, brother, you know, that all that training that you see depicted in those movies is about real life events. People who go home at the end of the day bruised, cut, bleeding. They have been pummeling their bodies so that their flesh might harden itself, so that the flesh might come to learn how to anticipate these blows, prepare for these blows, and withstand these blows as if nothing happened. That's hard. So all I wanted to do this morning is to add another layer to the two-part sermons that I preached before I went off, you know, for the meetings and the holidays. And so we were talking about maximums and minimums. Was trying to establish, you know, the idea there, thanks to material that I'd heard from a sermon by Homer Haley, that, you know, God expects from us nothing but gold. He expects from us no days off. He expects from us, even when we're on these physical vacations that we all take in this life, to be in training spiritually wherever we are on the planet and whatever we're doing. Whether it's work a day or the day off, time for myself and all these kinds of things, the athlete is still in training. And this is what Paul is trying to get us to understand. He's trying to get us to emulate his own life. He's trying to help us to take these admonitions personally, quite very personally. What I'd like to do now, though, is expand by stepping back in 1 Corinthians 9. To all the material that preceded, starting in verse 17, what was in Evan's reading and what was on that preceding screen. Paul had been building here to a conclusion. He had been building up to a great crescendo. So in 17, he had said, "If I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for I'm under compulsion. Woe is me if I do not preach the gospel, for if I do this voluntarily, I have a reward. But if against my will, I have a stewardship entrusted to me." I have to make my body my slave. I have to subdue it, he'll say. I have to, you know, take those blows down at the end of this chapter. But in the middle of this chapter, he's saying, there's no glory to me. As a matter of fact, I didn't even choose to do this. I recognize that God asked me, that God charged me, that God had expectations for me, that those expectations were high. And so, I'm under compulsion. The Lord of glory, Yahweh Himself, has asked me to do this. Now, if I respond, thy will be done. If I respond with the desire in my heart to be the faithful slave that I've beaten my body into, if I have subdued my will appropriately, if I do this thing willingly, then sure, there's a reward for me. But even if I do it grudgingly, even if I'm ordered into the ring at the Olympics after the year's training to perform in a fight that I want nothing to do with, how should I fight and how should I have been training? With every fiber of my being. To win the race, the wrestling match, the fight, the javelin throw, whatever it was, not to be taken the silver place, only the gold. So he's in a bind. But of course he's responding willingly. There will be a reward for him, but he recognizes that nonetheless, brethren, there's not just incentive of reward, there is the knowledge of compulsion. God is the master, God is the Lord, this he decrees, I must do the absolute best that I possibly can. I have a stewardship that's been entrusted. So in verse 18, what then is my reward? That when I preach the gospel, here's what I'll get. I can offer the gospel without charge, so as not to make full use of my right in the gospel. What is, Paul says, my reward after all this effort, time, and agony? My reward is to do it freely. My reward is to do this willingly. My reward is to have so prepared myself that I can do every job God asks of me for those who can't do it for themselves. I'm out in the world traipsing all over Europe and being driven out of city after city, beaten, imprisoned, shipwrecked, and all the rest, so they won't have to. I'm here to serve. I'm here to sacrifice. I'm here to offer. And this is my reward in this life. He took satisfaction. He counted it as profit to be able to do this. Not one moment is Paul selfish, begrudging, complaining, trying to cut corners, reduce his activity and time. He's trying to be a monster of success so that he can offer the gospel freely and take his personal satisfaction in that. But then in verse 19, "For though I am free from all men, I've made myself a slave to all so that I may win more." Well, there's a thought. He went from buffeting his body and making it his own slave to an understanding that he was a slave of the God of heaven. And on these two counts, I suppose we can find that relatively easy than to now submit and become a slave to people that will hate us, who won't understand us, who won't appreciate us, who will criticize us, who will imprison us, who will try to kill us. I'm going to spend my whole life, Paul understands, as a servant, a bondservant, a slave to those who are ignorant and unappreciative and would kill me as a result of all of my effort. And I do that freely. It's my reward that I might win more and more of them to Christ. Now, he's going to give the two examples. "To the Jews I became as a Jew," and I'm going to skip a few verses in here, or sentences, "that I might win those who are under the law, and to those who are without law," in verse 21, "as without law," again skipping a little, "that I might win those who are without law." Wow. This Paul, he's just amazing. His slavery, when he introduces it, moves through three different masters. And now he talks about being himself a slave to Jew and to Gentile so that he will constantly be changing himself to be more appealing to them so that they will respond to this gospel that he has been pounding his body and running his practice runs in order to get as good as he possibly can be so that then he'll put forth all the effort to just have them share, if you will, in the crown. He wanted to win them to his way of thinking, which means, brethren, that they too can win eternally as well. So he summarizes in 22 and 23, immediate two verses before the ones we've been reading, "To the weak, I became weak." Brethren, that is never easy. Takes self-control. Takes humility. When you see people that you recognize as being lesser than you, they're weak. Weakness generally is despised. It's looked down upon. The natural response is, "You weakling." And then we have arrogance and conceit and pride in all the wrong ideas. Paul says, "No, I'm buffeting my body. I'm exercising. I'm training. And when I come across people who are weak and ought to be faulted and criticized, exposed and humiliated because of their weakness, instead, I go to work on myself. I change me so that I can be more appealing to that which by nature we would despise, that I might win the weak. I become all things to all men." See the self-sacrifice of everything he thought of himself, "that I might by all means save some." Has Paul forgotten that the way is straight and narrow and few there are that find it? Does Paul not know that the sower goes out to sow in four different soils and only one of them is going to bear fruit? Paul knows these things. He knows that after this immense effort, all this price and cost and pain, This is going to be a small return on this investment. But he wants to do it so that he can offer the gospel without charge, so that he can change himself however he must to appeal to these others, even if they're just disgusting when they start and think of how they are. The immorality of the Roman Empire, the, you know, all that is just repulsive to what is pure and righteous and wholesome and good. And I'm adapting myself, not participating in sin, of course, so that I can appeal to them. By all means, to save some, I do all things for the sake of the gospel, so that I may become a fellow partaker of it. It is only, brethren, after all of that, that he said, run in such a way that you may win. Maximums of effort. Maximums of time. A maximum in sacrifice and commitment in faith. Count the cost. Understand that it's gargantuan. It's unthinkably high. Pay it. Pay it by adapting yourself, disciplining yourself, working yourself, becoming something magnificently more than you would be as the typical couch potato. Now, it's a curious thing. It kind of lends itself, you know, fairly well to my purposes this morning. You know, it just happens to be that is not Mount Olympus. These are the Olympics because they're named after Mount Olympus, ostensibly where Zeus had his throne. From the venue itself, you can't actually see Mount Olympus. That's the mountain. The mountain has just wondrous grandeur, does it not? Now, from the venue down the valley there, you know, you don't get to look upon it like that. But then, remember, Paul will say, everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we, an imperishable. We serve not Zeus, but God. We want to go home, not to a mountaintop, to heaven above. We will exercise self-control in everything because our ultimate reward, give the gospel freely on the earth, is one thing, and then to leave the earth behind and to enter into eternity, because this mortal will put on immortality and this perishable will put on imperishability, he'll say six chapters later in the 15th chapter. These people who work so hard on the Olympics, all they're going to get is their 15 minutes of fame. We, heaven itself. So we're going to close with a passage not found in 1 Corinthians, but just these two verses that open up Romans chapter 12. I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God. And Paul spent 11 chapters in the Roman letter discussing those mercies before he could draw this conclusion. He means 11 chapters of that. I urge you, brethren, by the first 11 chapters of Romans, which is about the mercy of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is, and the translation difficulty here is really serious, and you'll see it in every translation you pick up. It's a very difficult word to translate. As usual, I think both of the ideas that you have to pick from have equal weight, equal value. They're valid translations. They carry different ideas, and we need to remember them both. So, living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is either your spiritual service of worship, or, it's surprising to me, it's such a different concept, your reasonable service of worship. It only adds up. It's just sensible. You just see it. It's right. It's reasonable that we would offer our bodies a living and holy sacrifice. It is a spiritual sacrifice in a physical body. It is reasonable that we give absolutely everything we have, since we got absolutely everything from God, in service to Him. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind,
so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect.
Romans 12 in the first two verses is the grand underline to 11 chapters. He will then describe in great detail in the succeeding chapters many different examples of what this means. He will give counsel on how to fulfill that great quest. This is the goal. This is the finish line at the end of the Olympic racetrack. This is where we're trying to get. Bodies living and holy, sacrificed, because that is only right, reasonable, and spiritual service of worship. We accomplish this by refusing to make ourselves over into the world, conform to the world, but rather being transformed by renewing our minds to prove what the will of God is, good, acceptable, and perfect. So, this morning, hopefully you are in the last of our 26 miracles classes. We tried to draw, all that to a conclusion, that with the understanding that the book you hold came to be by prophets and apostles who most gave their lives that you could have that book on your lap. Gave their lives to prove that every word in it was true, and gave their lives to live every word that's in it. They gave their good and acceptable sacrifice themselves. So, we are to be transformed by the renewing of our minds, which is accomplished through that word. And then, training that mind will recognize what is good and acceptable and perfect. We will prove what the will of God is, first by identifying it and then by living it. So that's the end of the sermon. Not asking much. I want you all right now, leave home, go to the training field, start working out for the Olympics, and don't you dare take second place. Pack your bags. See, just in physical terms, your mind just reels at the thought. And look at our own Olympics today. If you haven't started by the time you're six, then it's too late. For physical Olympics, and in this great spiritual race, brethren, who is permitted to start and win? Can only be done from a young age? Or could you, at 97 today, be born again, baptized into Christ, and win the race starting today? That's awesome, isn't it?
Okay.
Brand new year. What better time to start? Maximums of service. Learning. Growing. Supporting each the other, playing our roles, which we'll be talking about in the weeks to come, so that magnificently we triumph. Go home wearing the crown, first place, every one of us, eternally, far above Mount Olympus, brethren, next to the throne of God. If you're not a Christian yet, today's the day to start. Believe that Jesus is the Christ, because He is. Repent of your sins, because they're awful. Confess His name, because He is your Lord. Be baptized that you might be washed in His blood and rise to walk in this new life, which is your reasonable service of worship, sacrificing self, living and holy for Him who offered His Son for you. If we can help in prayer, Bible study, in any other way, let it be known, please. Come and speak with me as we stand and sing.